Morning. I'd like to bring this meeting of House Fisheries to order. It is 10 o'clock on Thursday, February 21st, and President Representative Olson, Representative Feige, myself, Chair Seaton, and Representative Johnson is excused today. We can start receiving presentations without a quorum. So just so everybody knows, as other members come in, we won't have any action on any bills without a quorum, but we are going to be limited in time today because at 10:45 we have to go to the floor for House floor session. We'll be receiving Senator Murkowski's speech to us. And so today what we're going to do is take until 20 till, that's till 10:40, and look at our first issue, which is the sea otter science presentations. And then we will break at that time, and we'll have a short introduction of House Bill 110 before we leave for the floor. And testimony on House Bill 110 will be taken on Tuesday of next week. So just so everybody knows, I wanted to remind everybody that the to turn their cell phones off, and I'd like to invite the presenters forward for the sea otter science. And is it Ginny Eckert?
Verena Gill.
Okay, well, we have three people. Verena Gill is going to begin. Would you go ahead and identify who you represent for the record, and then proceed with your testimony? And before you do, we have been joined by Representative Grace Tompkins.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. My name is Verena Gill, and I am a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Marine Mammals Management Office in Anchorage, Alaska. So I'm going to give a brief synopsis on the current population status and causes of mortality for northern sea otters in southeast Alaska. First, I'm going to talk about trend and abundance of sea otters in the southeast stock, and then talk about causes of mortality. So first of all, population trend of sea otters. I just want to just explain a couple of things. There are three population stocks in Alaska. The Southwest Alaska stock, which is listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The South Central stock, which is not listed, and the Southeast stock, which is also not listed. All three, however, are protected by the Marine Mammal Protection Act. We're going to focus today on the Southeast Alaska stock, which essentially goes from Yakutat down to the Canadian border. And just some background history, sea otters were completely extirpated from Southeast Alaska during the fur trade. In 1911, there were no sea otters left in Southeast Alaska. So in the late 60s, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game translocated about 400 sea otters from two locations, one in South Central and one in Southwest stock. Over to Southeast Alaska, they translocated about 400 animals. And then now we have seen this increase that I'm going to talk about today. So that's just some background on historical background. There were otters left in the South Central and Southwest stock after the fur trade. There were 13 remnant colonies, but none were in Southeast.
And before we go on further, I just wanted to let the committee know that what we're going to do is have the presenters go through their presentation, and then there'll be questions at the end. Thank you. Go ahead.
So in 2010 through 2012, there was a comprehensive aerial survey of the Southeast stock. In 2010, I surveyed southern Southeast Alaska, essentially QU Island down to the Canadian border. In 2011, I surveyed the northern portion of the state, Baran off up to Glacier Bay, minus Glacier Bay, which was surveyed last summer. So essentially, it's an abundance survey. You fly transects, you count the number of animals, you correct for animals that you miss, and then you multiply it by the amount of area to come up with an estimate. So that's what I'm going to talk about now, the most current estimate. And USGS conducted the surveys in Glacier Bay. So the current population, we're estimating at 25,000 sea otters. The last comprehensive survey was around 2003, and that was about 10,000. That translates to a population growth rate of 12 to 14% across the entire stock. Now, it varies locally. In southern Southeast Alaska, it's about 12%. per year increase. In northern, it's about 14%. However, most of the growth is in Glacier Bay National Park, where it's a 20% increase of sea otters per year. If you take Glacier Bay out of the equation, they're only increasing at 4% in northern southeast. So what I'm trying to say is it's 12 to 14% if you combine the entire stock, but there are local differences. However, this may seem, in 2003, the population was 10,000, so it has more than doubled in that time frame. That may seem alarming to some people, but the population growth rate is in sync with what would you expect from a population that is expanding into new territory. So it's not, look at Glacier Bay, that's 20% per year that's increased, and Kachemak Bay is 22%, so it's not out of the realms of possibility. So this is the table from the latest stock assessment report, and again, we just shows you localized differences. In Glacier Bay, there are 8,500 animals. In southern southeast, 12,000. I'll just kind of gloss over this. If you want more information, I can provide it on that. But
okay, and I'd like to recognize that Representative Gaddis has joined us.
Thank you.
So now I'm going to just talk about range expansion, not numbers. Most of the range expansion into new territory has been in southern southeast Alaska. The three panels show surveys from 87, 2002-2010 periods, and the blue circles indicate areas where there has been range expansion. As you can see, and I'm going to leave Glacier Bay out of this, other than southern southeast Alaska, northern, there really hasn't been a lot of range expansion, and again, they're only growing at 4% unless you include Glacier Bay. So most of the expansion into new territory has been in southern southeast, the areas of Prince of Wales Island, and Kew Island, and you can see those blue circles up there indicating where the range expansion has been. The sea otters are now expanding up onto Admiralty. Just a quick closer look at southern southeast, because this is again where most of the expansion has been. The black circles show original translocation sites. The polygon in the red shows where sea otters were in 1988. The polygon in the green shows where they were in 2003, and the polygon on the orange shows where they were in 2010. So you can see that range expansion as they continue to recover into their original habitat from their extirpation. I'm not going to worry too much about this formula to go over it right now, but there's something called PBR, potential biological removal. It's the maximum number of animals, not including natural mortalities, that may be removed from the stock while allowing that stock to maintain its optimal sustainable population. And if you put all the numbers together, that number is about 2,000 animals that can be removed from the stock. However, remember that Glacier Bay is contributing to the large number of it's contributing 8,500 animals to the 25,000 that we have, but hunting, for example, is not allowed in Glacier Bay National Park. So when you're talking about removing 2,000 animals, you're really not talking about removing, there aren't 25,000 available if you minus Glacier Bay out, because it is not available for hunting. Quickly onto sources of mortality, they range from fisheries bycatch, natural disease, native harvest, and predation. Let's first talk about native harvest. Here's a graph showing the level of harvest since 1989 to 2012. The rate of harvest has increased over time, which of course you would expect since the population has increased. And the highest harvest we have experienced actually was in 2012, and that was 842 animals. The locations of subsistence harvest over the last 5 years, I've just have this table up here to show you where the major areas of harvest are. The community that harvests the most otters is Sitka, followed by Yakutat, Klawak, Craig, and then Hoona. And this is, again, the last 5 years. Oh, and I did just want to mention that even if you did take 2,000 animals from the population, the PBR, if you took all 2,000 animals from one particular area, you have to think about local depletion. It depends. Where you take that 2,000 animals from really can make a difference in what happens with the population. If the 2,000 is spread over the stock, that's one thing, but if that 2,000 is taken from a few key areas, that actually can have detrimental effects. I'm just going to move on to talk to you about the health and disease program that we run at Fish and Wildlife Service. When possible, we recover all carcasses that are reported across Alaska, send them out for various sorts of testing. On average, we get 80 carcasses a year from across Alaska to look at, but only 7 a year from southeast Alaska, unfortunately. We also do conduct live captures where we monitor animals for health and disease. The bottom shows when we did a capture in Cake a couple of years ago. The top is from an animal that died in southeast Alaska. So we send them out for all sorts of bacterial, viral, fungal tests. We look at zoonoses and diseases that are transferable from animals to humans. So all sorts of different things that we look at. One of the big projects that we have going is looking at paralytic shellfish poisoning, and we're working with NOAA on that particular project. And I just wanted to point out, when we did live capture in 2011 in southeast near Cake, we captured 31 animals, and of those 31, 30 had detectable levels of PSP in them. So sea otters are actually a really good canary in a coal mine, a good indicator of the health of the marine ecosystem. Obviously, what they eat, we eat, and that's why we have some of the conflict that we do, but they can also really help us tell what's going on and where we maybe should and shouldn't eat shellfish and harvest shellfish from. So the number, I'm just going to quickly talk about southeast Alaska. There's been 50 carcasses recovered since 2006, not too many. I'd like to see more, but it averages about 7 a year. Most of those are from Glacier Bay. Obviously, we have park rangers out there helping us, and also that's where most of the population, a large concentration of population are. A typical profile is an adult male that we get sent to us to necropsy. And just in summary, the number one cause of death in southeast Alaska and in Alaska in general is trauma. Whether that be non-reported hunting, gunshot, trauma from boat strikes, trauma from predation. Really not a lot of disease that we see in the population. In fact, if we look at the live captures and the carcasses, they're an extremely healthy population. We compare them to other otters, very disease-free, very good body condition, healthy. The only major finding that we have from otters in southeast Alaska is this PSP that seems to be detected in a large number of animals. I'm just going to put a plug in if you have iPhones. I developed this app for stranding that if you find any dead marine mammal, you can actually, you know, log in where you find it. It'll take your GPS and it'll send a note to us so that we can activate immediately and get a necropsy on marine mammals, because I would really like to increase the number of carcasses we get from southeast Alaska. Sea otters are so important for telling us what is happening in our niche or our marine ecosystem that I would really like to get that sample size higher for southeast Alaska. So spread the word, download Alaska Strand Net. It's free, and it really helps us out. So I'm going to turn over to Jim Estes now.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jim Estes. I'm a professor at the University of California at Santa Cruz. I've been working on sea otters and coastal ecosystems for the last 42 years. And what I want to do today is give you a brief overview of some of the things that we've learned about the impacts of otters on coastal ecosystems. So the basic question that we address is, what are the effects of otters on kelp forest systems? That's specifically what I'm going to be talking about. There are also soft bottom systems where things like clams live and that sort of thing, and I'm not going to be talking about that system. The approach that we have used to studying this problem is to use the history of otters as a natural experiment. Otters, as I think you all know, were depleted in the fur trade. They've recovered, and so we have used the depletion and recovery and comparisons of areas with and without otters that are a consequence of the fur trade to understand what their impact is on these systems. The main players in the system that I'm going to be talking about are sea otters, sea urchins, which are eaten by otters, kelps, which are eaten by sea urchins, coastal fishes, which live in kelp forest systems, and carbon dioxide, which we all know is an important element of our ecosystem today for a variety of reasons. Right? This is where we have worked. The area shown in red, in the circles in red, the Aleutian Archipelago, southeast Alaska, and Vancouver Island. And as I alluded to before, the approach is simply to compare areas with and without otters and to watch systems change as otter numbers wax and wane through time. That's what we've done over the last 40 years. Sea otters have a very strong direct effect on their prey populations in these systems, and these are data from both the Aleutian Islands and Southeast Alaska showing the abundance of sea urchins in systems where otters are present in the open squares and where otters are where they're absent in the open and where they're present in the black. And as you can see, there is a very strong effect, a very strong depleting effect by otters on these invertebrates, and we see that everywhere we've looked. These are some data showing the indirect effect of that interaction, because the sea urchins, which are fed on by the otters, feed on kelp. So here are some data from the same sites that show the abundance of kelp in places where otters are absent as compared with places where otters are present, again, both in the Aleutian Islands and Southeast Alaska. And as you can see here, the kelps are very much more abundant in systems where otters are present than where they're absent. And that's because of their effect on the sea urchins. So what we have in this system is what ecologists call a trophic cascade, a link in the system from otters to sea urchins to kelp. What I want to talk about now, and here's a photograph that shows from the Aleutian Islands generally what these systems look like when otters are present on the left and when otters are absent on the right. Now what I want to talk about is the influence of this sea otter-induced trophic cascade on other species and processes in the coastal ecosystem, because they are very strong and they're wide-ranging. I'm just going to give you a flavor for what some of these things are, as indicated by this little cartoon diagram that I'm showing at the moment. So here are data on the growth rates of one of the shellfish in the system. This is mussels. These are filter feeders. They make a living by feeding on organic material in the water column. And these show the growth rates of mussels in systems where otters are abundant compared with systems where otters are absent. And the growth rates are about twice as high where otters are abundant, and that's because of the kelp production in this system. It's fueling the system, and we see that in the growth rate of these mussels. Here's some data on fish abundance, showing the catch effort of one of the dominant fish species in the Aleutian Islands between systems where otters are abundant, the black bar, and where otters are absent, the gray bar. And what you can see here is there's about an eightfold increase in fish abundance in these systems. Here's some information, this will be the last bit of scientific data that I'm going to show you. These are some data on carbon in the system. And why would I even think about carbon in a sea otter system? Because carbon, otters affect plants. Plants draw down carbon dioxide in the process of photosynthesis. And so the question that we have asked is, what is the effect of this trophic cascade from otters to urchins to kelp on the carbon cycle in this system? And in particular, how does that relate to atmospheric carbon dioxide, which, as shown in this figure, has increased very dramatically over about the last 150 years since the Industrial Revolution, as everyone knows. And here are the data just showing that from a whole variety of samples going back about 1,000 years up to the present. And you can see this very sharp increase in carbon dioxide that has occurred in a global ecosystem. So our question is, do otters have any impact on this? And the answer is yes, they do. And here's just a model of what it is that we're thinking about, that is this trophic cascade from otters to urchins to kelp, and what effect the kelps have on sequestering carbon dioxide in the system. So what we have done is simply made some estimates based on the entire North Pacific Ocean of how much of the carbon dioxide in the coastal ecosystem would be held in living plants in systems with otters compared without otters. And what we find is, from across all of Alaska and British Columbia, that amounts to a difference of about 8.7 teragrams of carbon. That's a lot of carbon. That's a lot of carbon. This amounts to about 5 to 11% of the total atmospheric carbon pool. That is, about 5 to 10% of the total carbon dioxide in the system is going to be held in living kelps when otters are present compared with when they're absent. Or in a slightly different way, this amounts to about 20 to 40% of the anthropogenic signature of the increase in carbon dioxide in the system since the Industrial Revolution. So if you were to have otters throughout Alaska and British Columbia, they would reduce the amount of atmospheric carbon dioxide by these values. That's our computation. And we have actually put a value on this using the European carbon market in carbon credits, and we can estimate this value at about $300 to $600 million. That's about what that carbon would be worth on the carbon exchange. There's a slightly different way of looking at it. Carbon is held in kelps, but it also is sequestered in the process of photosynthesis. So this is a rate function. This is the amount of carbon that's actually being drawn out of the environment on a yearly basis. We don't know what happens to that carbon. Some of it goes into the deep sea, so we've made some estimates here, assuming that anywhere from a low of 1% up to a high of about half of that carbon is actually sequestered in the long term. And when you make those same computations on this flux basis and you compute the values of that, again, using the futures on the European Carbon Exchange as a means of doing that, those values range from a low of around $9 million a year that sequestered carbon could represent up to as much as $1.5 billion a year. So this is a huge area that we need more information on. So that's pretty much it. I wanted to convey to you this notion that what otters do in coastal systems is clearly very complex. They have a lot of impacts on different things that are going on in that system. They have direct negative impacts on kelp forest invertebrates. We see that. They have indirect positive effects on a variety of other species and ecosystem processes. These kelp forest ecosystems, the effects of otters are very diverse. They influence virtually everything in the system. And I would just argue, I think, that these various factors really need to be considered as you go forward and think about a management and conservation scenario for sea otters in Alaska. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you. And our final presenter is Jenny Eckert.
Thank you for inviting me. My name is Jenny Eckert. I'm an associate professor of fisheries at the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences through the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm based here in Juneau out at LENA, and I would welcome all of you to come out and visit us. I'd be happy to give you a tour and show you around the lab. So I'm going to talk today about the recovery of the sea otter population and then the resulting conflicts that have happened with shellfish users in southeast Alaska. And here's the bottom line. Sea otters like to eat the same things that we do. And as you can see here, there's a sea otter eating a Dungeness crab. So here's direct evidence, okay? This happens. There's no question in anybody's mind that sea otters eat a lot of commercially important species. But what we don't know is what is the magnitude of that effect. And so we've been trying to quantify that in my lab. There are two individuals that have been key to this. Zach Hoyt is shown in the picture in the bright orange slicker, and then Sean Larson in the black. Sean just finished his master's degree, and Zach is in the process of finishing his PhD. And this is pretty much mostly their work. We've been focusing on southern southeast Alaska because this is the area which the fishery conflict has been most intense. And in this area, there were two original release sites. So I'm going to zoom in on southern southeast Alaska in this image. And so you can see the two release sites quite closely. The one in the south is in the Barrier Islands, which is right near the community of Heidelberg. The one that's in the sort of middle area of southern southeast Alaska is in the Morrell Islands. This is closest to the communities of Kloak and Craig. These different sea otter populations grew at different rates. And Verena showed you this, but I'm going to go over it again a little bit. In 1988, so there were, just looking at the southern part of southeast Alaska, there were 106 otters that were introduced. In 1988, that grew to over 2,000 individuals. And as you can see, the Morrell Island population grew more than the one in the Barrier Islands. In 2003, then, it grew to close to 6,000 otters. And as you can see, once again, the Morrell Island release site grew a lot more than the one in the Barrier Islands. And then in 2010, the survey that Verena just talked to you about, there are now 13,000 otters in just this southern southeast area. And as you can see, the two populations are no longer distinct. And so what we think happened actually is that northern population grew down to the southern population. We can use this distribution and the different timing of when the otter showed up in an area to look at sea otter impacts. We can basically do a space for time substitution. So by studying different places that otters have been for different lengths of time, we can determine what the impacts of the sea otters are. These are the four primary fisheries that are affected in southern southeast Alaska: Dungeness crab, red sea urchin, California sea cucumber, and gooey duck clam. And the sea urchin fishery largely has had the market fall out of it for a variety of reasons. And in fact, the sea otter impacts probably happened quite a while ago with that species. I'm going to focus today on Dungeness crab and California sea cucumber. Gooey duck clam are very important, and there are major impacts of sea otters on gooey duck clams. As yet, we've been able to not quantify that. So quickly looking at Dungeness crab, one thing, the state of Alaska is really good at surveying most of their fishery populations. However, we do not have a survey for Dungeness crab. So we cannot go look at what the impacts of otters are quantitatively because we lack that data. So that's one thing I would put in. If it's possible, it would be great to fund a Dungeness crab survey throughout southeast Alaska to determine what the impact of sea otters is. What we can do is look at fishery impact, the sort of fishery response to what's going on. And so the different sub-districts, we've color-coded them here as to when they became commercially not viable. So basically, people stopped going there. And so the areas in green, we put the dates where the sea otters showed up in an area, and you can see where sea otters have been for longer, the fishery became not commercially viable. And then in the other areas in pink, that it's still commercially viable, but if I show you some data here looking at the amount of catch in these different areas, you can see that it's highly volatile. It fluctuates quite a bit. In the areas that aren't commercially viable, there's no catch. And in the areas where it is still commercially viable, we still see major declines. And that's because, for example, in the Cake area, that's where sea otters have recently invaded. We can map those polygons, the ones I showed you earlier, and they spatially correlate quite well. But this is as far as we can get without more specific data. So there are impacts to Dungeness crab, quite hard to quantify. For sea cucumbers, we're able to quantify this difference because the Department of Fish and Game surveys sea cucumbers. And they've been doing that since the late 80s. And so here's a really nice analysis, and this figure is quite complex. So I'm going to start in the upper left corner looking at panel A. This is 1994. And on the left-hand side, we're just going to look at the data where sea otters are present. So in the with sea otter column on the left. So in that top panel, you can see that what this shows is that before sea otters, so sea otters showed up sometime after 1994, and before sea otters were there, this is how many cucumbers were present. After sea otters showed up till today, now there are no sea cucumbers in that area. So where sea otters have been for a long time, the sea cucumbers are gone. We see 100% decline. Where sea otters colonized more recently, so looking at the next panel down, panel B, 2003, you can see that where there were sea otters, where there were not sea otters, there are quite a few sea cucumbers present, and then there's a decline, not as large as the previous decline. The decline is a function of how long sea otters have been there. And then looking at 2010, we still see a significant decline, but this decline is only 26%. But sea otters have only been in those areas for 2 years. So sea otters can decline sea cucumbers by 26% in 2 years. Now you might say, well, those declines could be caused by something else. And because we have such a nice rich data set, we can look at places that don't have sea otters, and we can say, well, do we see declines in areas where sea otters have never been? Are there other things that could cause sea cucumber declines? And in fact, that's what's on the right-hand side. And so we can use those same breakpoints in years to say, do we see declines in the absence of sea cucumbers using those same breakpoints before and after? And we do see declines. There are small declines, but they are much, much smaller than the declines that we see due to sea otters. These declines could potentially be from fishing. You know, we remove animals, there are fewer there. That happens. We know that. But these aren't big declines. And so the fishery is probably sustainably managed. However, this major predator is causing very large removals. To look at this just in terms of how many cucumbers are present in areas where sea otters have been for varying periods of time, you can see that there are virtually any cucumbers in areas where sea otters have been for a long period of time. And then, you know, where there are no otters, we see healthy sea cucumber populations. So there are major impacts on sea cucumbers, as demonstrated by this work. I'm going to tell you briefly about some of the work that we've been doing, collecting foraging data. We're interested in what is in the sea otter diet. We use these telescopes from shore a whole series of people that do this work, and you sea otters conveniently bring everything they eat to the surface. And so we are able to identify by species what they're eating. We've been doing this work over the last three summers, and we have collected over 6,000 observations throughout this whole region in southern southeast Alaska. And so what I'm going to show you here, the data set that I have here, this first panel is looking at commercially important species that are in the sea otter diet. This is the fraction of the diet that is each of these species. And I've done this by the year, basically, that sea otter colonized a particular area. And so we're looking at, basically, how does the sea otter's diet change as a function of how long they've lived in an area. And so the light blue bars, the lightest blue, are the areas that sea otters have recently colonized. And so you can see that when they've recently colonized, they eat a lot of red sea urchin. That's their favorite thing to eat. They also eat a lot of Dungeness crab. But these things are in their diet, even in places where otters have persisted for 40-odd years. So these things do not disappear. The prevalence in their diet just decreases. And for some things like California sea cucumber, they pretty consistently have about 5% of sea cucumbers in their diet. So think about that. I told you there were 100% declines due to sea otter predation from sea cucumbers, 100% declines in sea cucumbers from sea otters, and this is only 5% of the otter's diet. So they're having a big impact on something that they eat just a small amount. Abalone were never observed, and we've recently seen otters eating king crab. So that is going to be a growing concern. This is the non-commercially important species, and I should mention that particularly some of these, and particularly clams, are probably subsistence, very important to coastal communities for subsistence. And so we have not done an analysis on that. That's something that we're very interested in looking at, trying to quantify those impacts. But you can see that when they're eating other things, particularly a lot of urchins, they're eating fewer clams. But clams actually constitute the bulk of their diet. We still need a lot more information, particularly in southern southeast Alaska. It's a really remote area. We don't have very much information there. Some of these were touched on by some of my previous speakers, but we really need to know what is their role in this kelp forest ecosystem. There are likely positive fishery impacts, particularly herring, rockfish, salmon. A lot of these fishes rely on kelp, and as Dr. Estes said, kelp is a result when you have lots of otters. And then we're also really interested in helping the fishery community to make predictions and projections about what might happen in the future. Where are these otters likely to expand into? We don't know much about that. It might be that there are certain areas they won't go into. Is PSP going to keep them out of some areas? It's possible, but we don't know. We'd like to know the standing stock biomass of Dungeness crab. I mentioned that before. The fisheries are certainly responding to this. How are they responding to this is an important question. And then, you know, we'd love to know how many otters were there historically, originally. That's sort of the million-dollar question. I'm not sure we'll ever know that one. With that, I will say thank you, and then open it up to questions for all three of the speakers.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Representative Feige.
And I think this question would be for the first presenter. What population would the sea otters be eligible to come off the endangered species list?
They're actually not listed under the endangered species list in southeast Alaska. They're only protected by the Marine Mammal Protection Act.
And simply because they're marine mammals?
Under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, yes, correct. There are marine mammals that are protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. They're not listed under the Endangered Species Act in southeast Alaska.
And they're obviously not close to being endangered from what the data that you presented, right?
Correct.
Okay. And just for clarification, I don't know if you were here when they first said that they were threatened in the western population.
Right, I got that.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that everybody understood that. Further questions on the, let's see, on slide, on the sources of mortality, we have a slide, it's not numbered, but it's listing Kaufman Code, Craig, Huna, and all those. Those total subsistence harvests, are those representative of population density or just of where the human population happens to be close to? Or do you have a relationship that also puts this
compared to density in the area?
I mean, we could look at that, but they tend to be where the human population is and where culturally people have hunted. So, and otters have been in Sitka. There's a translocation site there. Otters have been in Sitka a long time since they were reintroduced. So these tend to be areas where there are a large native people's populations.
Thank you on that. It would be interesting to find out if we look at local depletions or something, if we compared that, the harvest areas, to the localized populations. I mean, it's nice to posit that there could be local depletions, but it would be really nice if we had somewhat population densities for these areas so we could see if we're seeing that impact or if it's kind of related to density as well. So,
well, I'll give you an example of Yakutat. That the harvest there has increased in recent years because the population in Yakutat has increased there quite substantially. We hadn't seen Yakutat as one of the higher, previous to the last 5 years, as one of the higher harvest areas, and they have definitely increased their harvest in the last 5 years as that population has increased there.
And that the subsistence harvest is mainly done for trade goods, for art artifacts, or is it done? I think we had testimony before that nobody eats sea otter.
Some people do, and some people do feed sea otter to their dog, but predominantly it is for the creation of authentic and traditional native handicrafts. You can sell, barter, trade sea otter pelts between native peoples, but if a native person wanted to sell a sea otter, they have to change that, significantly alter that into a traditional, authentic native handicraft in order to sell it to a non-native person. But native to native trade, they can trade green raw pelts.
Thank you. Further questions? Let's see. I had a question on the, again, it's not a number, on the kelp forest fish abundance slide that we had a bar. That was... Was that Jim? Was that you? Can you come forward there?
Sure.
This is Jane Estes. Question for you. The slide that shows catch effort, can you describe what catch effort is? Is that sport?
That was a study that we did using netting, trammel nets, and we fished for kelp forest fishes using trammel nets and simply looked at the number caught per unit of time fished. It's a fairly one of the ways that people assess fish abundance in certain systems.
So following up, so that was a research project using trammel nets that wasn't looking at either sport or commercial.
It was a strictly a research project. Yes.
Okay, great.
Yeah, and those data are from the Aleutian Islands, and they are for rock greenling, which are the dominant kelp forest fish out there. There has been similar work done on rockfish in British Columbia, and they've come up with fairly similar results. I didn't show you those data.
Great. Are there other questions? Seeing none. Really appreciate this. I think that the mitigation by sea otter slides there with the forest, the kelp forest versus no kelp, is very instructive. So thank you all very much for your presentation, and I hope we will be following this along as the presentations go forward. So thank you, and now we're going to move to House Bill 110. This is an introductory hearing only. To get it on the table, we'll take testimony starting on Tuesday. Doug, would you come forward? This is a bill that I've sponsored. You've got the sponsor statement. You've got fiscal notes and other things in your background. But Doug, would you go ahead and present the bill? And we'll do this in a rapid manner because we need to be on the floor at 10:45.
Absolutely. For the record, my name is Doug Duncan, staff to Rep. Seaton. I'm here to give a brief introduction to House Bill 110, which prohibits the use of barbed hooks for freshwater fisheries where the retention of catch is prohibited, and also for freshwater fisheries where there's a significant chance of bycatch of stocks where retention is prohibited. So this piece of legislation has largely been motivated by instances of low Chinook abundances in river systems like the Yukon, Kuskokwim, and Cook Inlet, and also concerns that have been raised on the Kenai of late, that is a significant sport fishery. Also, there's other impaired waters like Alexander Creek, which is encountered, which has been subject to invasive pike. And all of these have led to various cutbacks of all user groups, subsistence, commercial, sport, which has resulted in both cultural and economic hardships for everyone of extremely significant magnitude. We've, Governor Parnell in the fishery disaster declarations put the impact at about $10 million, and even that is subject to increased revision. So what this is doing is attempting to put in place another conservation measure that will reduce mortality of fish to fish from sport fish users who are in catch and release fisheries. The Pacific Salmon Joint Technical Committee concluded that there's about a 2.6 to 3.5% reduction in mortality for released fish using a barbless hook. So it also reduces handling of fish, which leads to reduced mortality. And the hope is that this will allow utilization of stocks to continue and fisheries opportunities to be maintained while still protecting our valuable aquatic resources. So we want to maintain opportunities, but still protect the resources like Chinook and trophy trout that are found throughout our state.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions? One thing I would like to point out is that Washington and Oregon have instituted this in their Chinook fisheries. They have a slightly different aspect in that the fish that are wild stocks are required to be released. The fish that are hatchery fish have a fin clip, and so what they want to do is retain those fish that are legal to be retained, but those that are required to be released, that's a wild stock, they want to limit the mortality on those. And that's why they did those studies that showed the 2.6 to 3.5 reduction in mortality. And we'll have data, further data, but there have been studies done here that indicate that the mortality on fish that are caught and released in Chinook are about 8%. We'll get the exact numbers. But if we were looking at a reduction from 8% to 3.5%, we're talking about a much reduced impact when you have a sport fishery that's had to go to catch and release, and therefore it should provide much greater opportunity to continue to have those sport fisheries take place and provide that recreational opportunity. I think there's been some question that this was attempting to establish catch and release fisheries. This bill does not do that at all. This says that if there is a catch and release fishery declared, then what we want to do is reduce the mortality that occurs in that to keep Fish and Game from saying, oh, numbers are really low, we're going to have to even close the fishery entirely. So anyway, with that, Representative Gaddis.
I know we're limited for time. I do have a question, and maybe the answer I'll have to hold over, but I did want to go on record. In regards to enforcement of this barbless hook and whether they're using it or not, what is the fiscal note and what will it cost using our safety officers to enforce this?
And that's a question that is a good question to put on the table.
There you go.
And we'll want to make sure that we have that looked at as the bill goes forward.
Thank you.
Anything else? So with that, Fisheries Committee is adjourned at 10:45.